OPN Ask an Angel podcasts are conversations with global angel investors and venture capitalists. We explore how to invest, understanding investment strategies and approaches to due diligence. Join us and learn what it takes to be a startup or what it takes to invest in the next great company.
Welcome to Supporters Fund Ask an Investor. I'm your host, Jeffrey Poffin. Let's please welcome Carrie Ransom, Managing Director at BankTech Ventures, founder at Operate, as our investor for today. Welcome, Carrie. It's a real pleasure having you join us.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Brilliant. I'm super excited to chat with you, Carrie. We've chatted a few times over the better part of the last year, and there's been so much amazing stuff that I've got to learn from you and the things that you've shared. And so I'm excited to kind of dive into this and break this all apart. And I've got some really specific questions because you're doing something that not a lot of investors do, which is this whole venture studio world. So I'm really excited to kind of dive in and learn about that and help the audience learn more about where all these pieces fit in this early stage ecosystem. But to start, the way we like to kick our show off is that we want to allow you to share your background, and you can go back to the school side, the family business, all these great things. Share a little bit about yourself and what you guys have been up to. And then one thing about you that nobody would know.
Well, Jeffrey, thank you. And you mentioned the venture studio. I think going back in time is probably what led me to why I'm doing what I'm doing and how I'm doing it today. And so, you know, for me, it goes back to growing up in a 100-year-old family business. And I started working when I was really young, partly because I was curious about, you know, what did my dad do? What did my grandpa do every day? And what we had this local retail business that had been multi-generationally in my family. And it was really what brought our whole family together. So in a world that is probably becoming and continues to become increasingly less tribal, that was kind of the clan that I grew up in. And it was where I would say a lot of my early learning came from, about how to treat other people, how to think about the interplay and dynamics of a community. And we were in this little self-contained town that at that point in time, it weirdly was starting to change, in that it probably wasn't quite big enough for the world that was growing around it and the expectations that people had from what a community or the world could give them. But it was this really interesting, almost laboratory, as I look back at it, that I got to experience and also try a lot of things. I got to work with a lot of different people. I got to see the value of education, because a lot of them were not as well read or well-educated as I quickly became, even as I got through high school. And you know, I'm so grateful to my parents, because they exposed me. We traveled quite a bit when I was a kid, and they exposed me to this larger world. And just between that and I was a voracious reader, it just unlocked me. And I was this really curious kid, always asking people questions. And ultimately that led me to say, I have to go get to a bigger pond somewhere. I went to a big school. And part of that was just to challenge myself and say, you know, can I compete in a bigger place? And I was pretty successful there. And then I found myself in a big city and wanted to see, you know, could I survive in the big city? And I ended up in Chicago. And very shortly after that, because I started in an industry, I started in the consumer products industry, which was somewhat comfortable, because I'd kind of grown up in a world where we were moving consumer products through our retail family business. But I was just always intrigued by technology. And I'd had a computer in my house as a young kid, and I tinkered a little bit with programming in BASIC, which will date me. But I finally said, you know what, I need to go make this really a part of what I do. And so in the mid-90s, I talked my way into a software company, and got a job in a software company, and realized, okay, this is where I need to be. And so if you look now across the last, you know, almost 30 years, my life has been primarily in and around technology companies. And, you know, I've done 8 startups that I have joined from either founding or really early team, or coming in as a really early executive. And, you know, I've had that entrepreneur and founder mindset And I know we'll talk more about that. And I kind of look at it as you can have that, whether you were there at the drawing board when the idea was conceived or not. But I have a lot of life learnings now in the rearview mirror that really inform where I go as we look ahead. And, you know, it's things like company building is a team sport, and I want to be, you know, a part of teams that are going to have high conflict, high interaction to try to find the opportunities and the best ideas and do that quickly. And that informs a lot of how I look at investing today. And so it's been just an incredible journey. I've had some amazing successes. I've had some miserable failures, and it's just been a really fun journey to be on. And primarily what drives me is this continued curiosity to understand how things work today, how they might work better, and how to incorporate new and emerging ideas that are coming from humanity on how to do things better that just continues to propel our world forward. And so I feel such a privilege to be able to be out on closer to the front edge of that with how you apply a lot of these new technologies and new ideas to problems that can be better solved because of them. And so about 3 years ago, I walked out of my last operating role in a startup. I was COO of a neobank, which many of your audience are probably familiar with these non-bank startups, and we scaled it really fast and, you know, became a unicorn. And I put a lot of new team in place and said, you know, this, I think, is my last full-time operating role. And from here on out, I feel like serial entrepreneur, serial startup involvement is probably the best way for me to apply all of these experiences and skills. And so that led to starting what ultimately became Operate, which is our version of a venture studio. And it's different from every other venture studio out there. And I think what I learned in the process was you meet one venture studio, you meet one venture studio. And there are a lot of things that are like that. And there really isn't a singular way that those work. And we said, look, we're operators. My partner and I both have built a lot of companies and learned a lot. And we said, we'd love to work with early founders. And if we can put our experience and capability and some capital with some early founders, we think we can help be force multipliers on a bunch of other companies propelling forward. That's how we'll do it. And we'll treat each one as a creative outlet for us and the founders. And we don't have a singular model in how it works. And so that's, you know, our version, and we can talk more about that. And then, you know, just quickly to close off on Bank Tech Ventures, which is a new fund that I helped with some partners launch and now manage about a year and a half ago. We are really there. I call it an industry ecosystem consortium fund, where we're a strategic investor for the future of an industry. And in this case, it's community banking. And we are out looking for entrepreneurs who want to help digitize and transform and help make community banks more competitive and relevant in the years to come. And we invest on behalf of just over 100 community banks, which we look at as a proxy for the whole industry, to find those companies that can be meaningfully impactful to them. And our team is comprised of both people who are out meeting those entrepreneurs and looking at, are these good investments that we should be making, as well as an equal size part of the team that focuses on how to help bring those entrepreneurs to the banks and help the banks understand how to incorporate them and benefit from them. So we really have sort of a two-pronged team.
That's pretty cool. Fantastic background. And of course, being able to share that you've got 8 startups under your belt, but not only that, lots of investments, lots of advisory side. So you really have taken a real deep dive approach. I'd say it's pretty agnostic as well. It's not hyper-focused in one sector. So there's a ton of different learnings that you've gained.
And I know very little about a lot.
Which is great too. I think all those little things help challenge you to keep pushing forward, right? Your curiosity is going to pique you to get into. So I think it's a real cool
tool belt of different learnings. Now, when you take back, just before we dive in, one thing about you that nobody would know, I have to kind of get that out there. It's always a fan fave.
So I that's a good one. I've often used the family business that, you know, I grew up in, that my dad sold 4 years ago, and it was 146 years old. So it almost made it to 150 years old in my family. It still runs. It just now owned by someone else. The thing that I probably would say that, you know, very few people know about me is I really consider myself a geek in that I just love so many different topics of information. And like, if you looked at the podcasts that I listen to or the things that I read, it's just so vast. And so I think, you know, I tend to talk to people about things that they have interest in and find the common ground with them, but I have so many different spectrums of content and topics that I'm interested in that I think that's probably the thing that I don't tend to share with people. They probably think I read and I'm interested in things mostly like them, because that's usually what I talk to them about. But I have a lot of other topics that I probably never cover with them because it's not obvious that it would make sense to. So, and maybe there are other people like that, but I don't think most people see that as obvious about me with, you know, the things that I put on social media or end up talking to most people about.
I think that's awesome, because when you dive into it as a generalist, you're able to look at and blend in well with a startup that's sharing or pitching a business model. And by the end of the conversation, they're looking at like you've already invested and you've been building this company with them for the better part of the last 3 to 5 years, even though it's only been half an hour talking to them. So I think that's an incredible skill. And it does come from being able to blend across the table and say, hey, you know what, there's similarities here, or I've read a lot on this topic and I can kind of help you feel more comfortable about what you're trying to build. And I think that brings a lot of value to founders, even though they may not realize it at the beginning. They're going to be attached to it right away, because again, life's tough no matter how you skin the cat. It's even tougher when you're trying to build a company that people can't understand.
That's right. I do find, I mean, it almost scares me at times, Jeffrey, that I do find at times that founders go, wow, you know a lot more about this than I thought you did. And I kind of say to myself, I don't really know that much, but you know, I'm at least a little bit familiar with it. But sometimes they just get excited because maybe this is one out of 10 people they've talked to who actually knows the language and some of the dynamics of this area. And I go, now I'm going to be over my skis really fast if I have to go much farther. So I've even at times said, you know, maybe my best attribute is I'm a good plane ride friend, because I could sit next to somebody on a plane and probably have a conversation with them for the length of the plane ride, but then I might be in trouble after that.
Oh, well, hopefully it's a short plane ride, so then you have something to pick up on later. But that's right. I think it's a great skill. Honestly, I think it's helpful. And having that operational background really does help other people kind of better understand even their own business once they have someone that's coming in from with that outside objective view. I think it really can change the way someone, you know, projects forward and what they're doing. So I think it carries a lot of value. And I kind of wanted to go back and kind of peel back on a few things that you mentioned. And I find it really fascinating, because you utilize that when you first started working in your family business, you realized that it was becoming less tribal. And what I love about that is that in all of our previous podcasts, there's been, I would say, an underlying tone that life, when you're building forward something, you need to find your tribe. Mm-hmm. And it is so common that we do want to find that tribe. And that could be from anything, from school, religion, sports. There's always a tribe that you're trying to figure out where you fit in. And especially this is really key when you're building your first company, is finding people that are like-minded, that understand what you're doing, from investors to employees, all the way through founders. And you saying that this was becoming less tribal, but then it sounds like all the things you went forward doing was very tribal.
Yes.
So does that less tribal mean that you were looking at this as maybe this business is going to transition at some point? It's not doing the things that I see it wanting to do, and I have to go find the tribe where I'm going to fit in better. and accomplish that. Is that a fair way of breaking that down?
I think absolutely in that case. And I think some of it is, you know, just the societal definition of tribe. If you go back in human history, and it was very much familial for a long time, and you had, you know, inbreeding literally. And I think as we've moved into a more educated and even to some extent independent Western societies that have influenced, you know, much of the world now, I think the definition of tribe has just changed a little bit. And it now has many different, and you mentioned several of them, many different connection points that might be your, so I think it's more of a semantic term now in my mind. In my case, I was in a business that had been very successful for a long time, and something was telling me that continuing to just do the same thing was not going to guarantee success for the next several decades. And I didn't really want to do the main things that they had been doing. And I think I felt constrained by it. And so to your point, I felt like, okay, I can have this life, but you know, I've heard people say this before, where if you see your entire life in front of you, like if I project and said, I'm going to have the next version of my father's life, it's not your life. And I needed to have more of my own life, my own adventure. And I think my parents recognized that. I recognized that and said, you know, I just think I've got to go figure this out myself. And I think your view of finding your tribe is probably a great way to think about what I probably felt the pull to, is I have to go find the people that are going to challenge me and fill me. And that's an adventure I feel like I've been on for a long, long time, and I've been a part of a number of different tribes, whether it was at, you know, university or in the city or graduate school or startup communities or others that I've been a part of. And it's just been so life-giving to me over those last few decades.
And it's pretty impressive that you saw this early on and you were able to kind of start to drive your way towards that and really classify this as a tribe gathering and what you wanted from that tribe. And it falls really closely to a startup space where when you are starting to create your business and you're trying to figure out, how do I start this? Where should I go? And people always tell you a million different things on how you should start your own company and what you should look for and how you should do it. But it really sounds that there's a real definition towards finding that tribe, but not only from a sales perspective, but just getting people that align early on. If that's three people in your company, those three people need to be part of that tribe. And what are some of the things that you look for? Like what you said, a gut feeling, there's a lot of drive towards that. But what is this tribe that everybody's trying to find and that's going to help them build a better business or stay on track to build the right business or be learning to pivot? Like what are those things that really help you? Is that finding a tribe of investors that only invest in this type of company and then making them a mentor? And some of the stories you were sharing earlier where it was aligning to putting that focus in on it and saying, hey, this is what I'm going to do and I want to raise $100 million. And you're like, hold on, that's not really what you should be looking at doing here. This is something, a better approach. Is it really trying to understanding those facets of a tribe?
Yeah, I think it is. And you know, one of the things that I like to assess in a founder is, and I think this is where storytelling is such a powerful skill for founders to have, because really they're envisioning a future state of the world that they have successfully shaped and moved forward in the area that they're focused in. And so their ability to articulate what that's going to look like, why that's going to happen, and how they're going to be part of it is so useful for them. And it's also powerful in attracting in those people they need around it. And to your point, it's not a singular group of people. You could have a founder who is really good at selling this future value and vision to customers, and nobody wants to work with them because they're just very difficult, you know, when it comes to empowering others or encouraging others or managing others, whatever that may be. And that's, you know, sometimes you still would support them with that and trying to hope that you could help develop their skills. But I think that, as a magnet to building that tribe, which could be customers, business partners, you know, employees, potentially investors, the others around, I think that is a key part of the evaluation of, are you a founder that in any of those roles? I've evaluated it many times in my career from the business partnership standpoint. Do I want to join you and put my time and talent and treasure? And because a lot of the startups that I've joined, I've literally invested in the company as an investor and someone who's going to join the team and be a key part of the team. And whatever role I can play that can be additive to that, I've literally had every job that you could have in a company because I don't care. I'm like, let's put the best team we can together and let's go win. And that's how we're going to have our best opportunity to go shape the future. So I think, you know, that ability to articulate the vision in the future and that ability to attract others to it, to want to be a part of that and be part of something bigger than themselves, I think is a key part of building that early startup tribe.
And with this tribe, you mentioned that over time, people start to lose, get distracted, start not to feel part of that. Does that mean that this tribe is going to keep shifting and changing and that you should look at it as the people that are here today are not going to be the people here in 5 years or 10 years? So just know that you're going to get the best out of all of these people in your tribe, but just know that they'll be kind of an auxiliary tribe. They'll be the outside tribe. They'll still be there supporting you, but they may not be in your business and you kind of have to grow with that and that's okay.
100%. Now, the hard thing there, you and I have lived through that. For a younger founder who's never experienced it, I think that's a hard conversation to have early on because they just don't, I'm different, it's different, we're different, whatever it is, it's almost a distracting conversation in the early stages that, you know, telling somebody, for example, don't get too close to this group because most of them probably aren't going to join you as you get from 4 people to 40 people to 400 people. It's almost a conversation that I don't think is worth having until it's time to have it, is sort of been my conclusion. If a founder wants to have it with me, I will have that conversation all the time. And I have stories and experiences for days I can share about how to help with those transitions and do it effectively, how I've seen it done very poorly, painfully, and often I will offer them options when it comes time and say, here are a few options that I've seen or that I would propose you might want to consider. And, you know, ultimately it may be your decision if you want some recommendations. As most people who meet me find, I very commonly will say, I have opinions on virtually everything. Because in a lot of cases, it's because I've already lived through it and it's gone well or it hasn't gone well. And that's helped shape my opinion. But whether that opinion or that view is good or not is not necessarily up for me to decide. That's really more either for you or the market or others. And so I come with honesty and candor and as informed an opinion as I can. But ultimately, some other evaluation is going to occur on whether the quality of that's high or not.
But I think that's really valuable in the sense that you can utilize that past experience and skill set to enable those founders or the business people to better understand what they're going to be faced. Because I think firing someone the first time is the most discouraging thing you can do. Because
it's the worst. I mean, I feel like it's the worst part of work.
Totally. And you don't know how to manage it. There's a lot of feelings. There's a lot of things that you're not used to and it's thrown at you. And, you know, it could put you into the wrong space in the future, which means that every time you do have to let somebody go or change a direction, panic or whatever, there might be a lot more things that come into it. So having somebody that understands this and has gone through this space, which also kind of refers back to another reference that you made, which was when you were an entrepreneur and because you built companies, been part of early stage companies, that also kind of really sums up this, the comment you made, is that as an entrepreneur or being an entrepreneur, you got to act like you own the business and you've got to work yourself into that space and take a different mindset. And I think that's actually pretty amazing on how you shared that. And I'd love to explore that, because it kind of fits in with this tribe piece, is that you're saying, hey, I'm part of your tribe, but I'm also not just someone at the bottom of this tribe. I want to be part of this tribe 100%. I'm going to treat this like I own this business. Even if I don't, I'm going to do that. How do you put yourself into that mindset? Because I think a lot of founders or co-founders or people that want to be really tied into a company, they tend to just treat this like a nominal job. Like, I'm in and out, don't care. I'll be gone in 5 minutes, or gone at five and I'll be gone in 6 months. I'm going to find another job. How do you get people to change their mindset around to act like they own that initiative or own that role and be better so that they can provide more value into the business? Because they never know that that might actually become their tribe and they may want to be there for the next 10, 20 years.
Yeah, it's a great, great question. I think in my case, I was given a gift by the fact that I grew up in this family business and we owned it. And I was, by designation of being part of the family, even though I was the lowliest person there when I was, you know, sweeping up sawdust in the yard, there was kind of this sense of pride of, hey, I'm part of the family and I'm not entitled. And I think there's always that potential that entitlement can set in. I didn't feel entitled. I felt a sense, I have to prove that I should be here, because you know, they could probably fire me and go find somebody who's better at sweeping. But I think some of it starts with just personal pride of doing great work and wanting to put your time and attention to things that you can do well and show people, hey, I'm good at this. And so I think some of it starts with the human and the individual and saying, if you're going to do things, I'm a big believer, if you're going to spend your time doing things, do them the best you can. And then on the other side, if you're given an opportunity, I mean, this is why I love startups, in that in most startups, everyone's been being given some amount of equity, and they are literally given the option for some ownership. And so there is a financial alignment there, which I find good, but it is also, to you, what you said, it's a mindset. And if I'm going to spend my time being part of something, I want to be part of something with my whole person. And I want people who are also thinking that way. And there are times where you just need somebody to do a good job for you, and it is a job. And I think increasingly what you see in the marketplace is those people I might just hire as contractors or as business partners, but that core group, you want that emotional and intellectual buy-in from. And sometimes it's about giving them the financial access, and that helps do it. And then I think in other cases, it's about giving them the agency and the ownership, literally, of some amount of the work to do it. And so I don't think you can have people in a company that you want to think like owners and then you don't treat them like owners. Like, you can't cut them out. And so I think culture is important in how you think about enabling, empowering, giving people agency and, you know, some amount of ownership and authority to a level that makes sense. That helps reflect it. So it's a multifaceted thing in my view, but I think you can sometimes get people there. Sometimes you can't. And so I also try to really screen for people who do want that.
I love that. And I think there's a fine balance between how much you need to take on and how much you can distribute to the team. And why I say it's fine, because I think we go in thinking we have to run and operate all of it, and that we have to be the end result to all of it. And I believe that's the incorrect way of looking at it, that you're going to grow faster and be scalable once you start to empower everybody. And once that empowerment occurs, then the ownership of feeling that they're an owner and they're a driver of this business, that they matter, is going to change the dynamics of how that business runs. And maybe that goes to your other point, which is the level of curiosity that that individual has. And if they don't have the curiosity, to your last point, maybe they're not really the best fit. But if they have that curiosity and drive, that's going to keep them motivated to keep pushing the business forward.
That's right. I totally agree. Maybe that's the number one trait I tend to look for and hire for is curiosity. And partly because curiosity typically means people are pretty humble. They realize how little they know, and they're motivated and driven to continue to learn, and almost fed by the opportunity to grow and learn. And especially when you're in a startup, you typically want people that can grow and learn and take more on over time, because especially in those early days, you don't have people that you generally want who have done this job before. The reason you're starting a startup is because you think there is a different way to do something and better way to do something. And you need people very open to the idea of how to potentially do something much differently and better. And so people that have done it a way may come in and not have that curiosity and willingness to shape and change things in a very different way. That is the whole reason you exist. So you need those very open people and willing people to be part of that, particularly the early tribe.
I love it. I think there's a lot of great learnings here on how to shape a team early on and how people can start to build that tribe and build the curiosity in the people there. And a lot of it seems to come back to empowering them financially and through all aspects of the business. And now you take what you've done, which is you've accelerated these companies. You've dived into so many companies today. And when we were chatting before, you were like, that's what gives me energy, was it's not being in one area, one company, one, it's across many spectrums. So you're being challenged all the time, which is to an earlier point you shared, which was, I want to challenge myself. So I think you're at full challenge. So challenge is at 1,000%. Can you explain what the difference is between a venture studio, an accelerator, incubator, and should these all work together? Is there a cross-pollination of these as an entrepreneur founder? Like when I come to you and I say, you know what, I'm lost. I got to create a company. I'm looking for funding. This is what I do. You love the company. You love that there's a tribe, but you're like, you need to go an accelerator first, then come see me. Or is it come see me, then go? I think there's a confusion because we always hear all of these terms and they all seem to layer into the same, which is I'm getting help from somebody that has a lot of helpers. And but the names are so confusing. Which one should I start with, or where should I go? Maybe you can kind of break that out a little bit.
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think it is confusing. I totally agree with you. I tend to not accept the names. We for, you know, as humans, we like names of things because we're lazy. And I need to go to, as you said, I need to go to an incubator. I need to go to an accelerator, whatever. When we started operating, people were like, are you an incubator? Are you an accelerator? I said, no, we're a studio. They go, what's a studio? I go, exactly. Don't worry about what the name is. Worry about what it can help provide once inside. And so what I would always, and I do this frequently, encourage a founder who says, I need help. Where should I go? Is go a couple levels deeper and understand what do they need help with. Do they need help with getting the problem that they think they're solving validated? Do they need help with getting capital? Do they need help with getting people to want to be part of what they're trying to build? What is it that they actually need help with? And I think in so many cases in our world, if you show up at somebody's door and say, I need help, and they're in the business of giving help, they may try to force their capability on you. And you go, well, I showed up at their door. They said they could help. So I'm here. And I tend to look at it the other way and say, the clearer you can be about what help you need, the better you're going to match with exactly the right help. And, you know, I'll give you an example. One of my partners on the bank tech fund, he runs an accelerator for banking tech startups. And what he does, it is a true business accelerator. And so if you have a company that is trying to get into and work with community banks, he has an acceleration program where you will apply and join his program. And over the course of 10 weeks, you will get in front of 250 community banks. And so he would say, if you are going to benefit from being in front of 250 community banks in the next 10 weeks, you may be a good fit for our accelerator. If you just need broad business acceleration advice, we're probably not the right fit for you. And if you're a super early stage company and you need feedback from a couple banks to tell you if you're on the right track, you're probably not a good fit, because you're going to drive 250 banks crazy over the next 10 weeks with a solution that hasn't been vetted and thought through enough. And so there's, he's found the boundaries of where are they in their business life cycle. He's ended up with some mature companies that said, this is an incredible business development opportunity for us. We'll come in and be part of this. Because so I think sometimes it's the clarity on the side of the provider, but it's also really going a little bit deeper as a founder to understand, where do I need help, support, business partnership at this point? Because even, you know, as we were talking earlier about studios, there are a lot of different studios that could, in your case, look like some incubation help, could look like some acceleration help, depending on where you are. And it is a bit of a matching process, and I would say also a matching problem.
It sounds like the key to figuring out as a startup company where, or even a scaling or mature company, is that you need to look more internally at what are the problems you're facing and write those down and define, if your team can't solve these problems, then who can solve them? Is it a consultancy? Is it an accelerator? Is it an incubator? So I think what it kind of sounds like people are doing is they're not actually trying to solve their problem. They're trying to fit into somebody else's solution because they don't know what they don't know. That's the biggest fear, is that I need someone to give me, as I call it, the Canadian hug, because Canadians look for hugs. Americans give the Heisman. So it's the capitalist versus the socialist environment. And so people are always running around looking for, I'm missing my hug. Someone's got to help me. And I think we have to figure it, go deeper and figure out what is our real problem that we're trying to solve. And then find the people that actually solve that niche problem, because you're going to end up spinning and wasting time if you don't look at it from, as you say, internally and figure out what you're really trying to find.
Totally agree. And look, sometimes you may go into a place, you don't know what you don't know, and you have serendipity and you just meet that right person who's in there, who loves what you're trying to do. And they're there to help you, and they help you immensely. And they maybe even help you realize what you need. So that can still happen. What I, you know, having done so many of these, what I really try to focus on are, how do you increase the likelihood that you can get it right? And there's no guaranteed success formula or pathway. And, you know, I like when people say the default posture for starting a company is failure, because the vast majority of them fail. So what are the things you can do to increase the likelihood that you actually succeed and don't fail? But the default position is you're going to fail, because most of them do. I mean, you have to be pretty crazy to try something that has very, very low odds, like starting a company does.
I love it. And it's, I think it really shapes for kind of our next segments. And that is, if we were to dive into a case study that shows what it takes to be an entrepreneur, what would be something that you could share? And it could be win losses, but I think the audience gets a better view when they're learning about these little different facets that you may not think about. And now you're sharing, you know, it is a tough life and it is a tough grind. And if there is a high fail rate, you want to get to success faster, and you need to do all of these things, include people, tribes. There's a lot of things that will help this be successful. Can you share something of maybe a founder or a business that you've created where it blew your mind on where it went and the outcome, but positive or negative?
So I mean, let's start with the founder first. I mean, I you know, one of our mantras at Operate is, you know, founders we can love. And so lovability takes a lot of different forms, but, you know, one of the things that I really gravitate to and love is this founder who is very clear that for this season of their life, this is going to take over their life. Like, this is what they need to do. They have a really strong why. They have a really strong view of, I have to go do this. It's not, hey, you know, I was lacking other things to do and we just had this idea, so we're going to go try this. It's, I'm obsessive about solving this. And it's usually in the early stages, especially, it's, in my mind, it's not about building a business. It's about the people they're trying to impact, the customers, the market that they're trying to be in, that they want to change. They want to go forever change that world. And so that, to me, is a key lovable trait, is that person that just, they're out on the spectrum and this is something they have to go do. And then that will help, in my mind, typically means that's going to help with them telling this story to get other people to join them in this journey. And so we start with that. Then we start next with, okay, are they working on something that we can get excited about? Because again, we're all humans, and I'm going to be much more helpful and proactive to somebody when I think it's a really interesting problem that they're trying to solve, and a really interesting group that they're trying to solve it for. And so we then, you know, typically go there next. And then the last one for us is, can we be a force multiplier? Can we help them get there faster? Can we help them be more efficient? Are we going to have good chemistry in how we work together? Because to your point, it's super hard and the likelihood this works is low. So what are the things we can do to increase those odds? And, you know, I often, and sometimes we even say, create unfair advantage. Do we know some people that we can help attract in to join them that are going to give them even more advantage to potentially be a winner?
And I love that part that you said, because you've said this a couple of times, be a winner. So I love that. I think that's fantastic. It's a great way to kind of summarize everything that you're looking at, is whatever I build or whatever I do, can I be the best at it? And can I win? And let's go win.
Yeah. And you can probably gauge. I mean, I'm a really competitive person. And, you know, even I have three boys at home, and, you know, it's kind of, you know, whether we're playing a game or whatever, it's just, it's fun to compete. And, you know, I don't always win anymore because they're getting older, but it's the spirit of that competition. And so I think in, you know, a startup founder who feels compelled to have to go do this, there's a competitiveness there in that I have to go do this, so I better go do it well.
I love it. Agreed. Okay, we're going to swap into the 60-second rant. I think you've been prepped for this. I'm going to set my timer. And we were going to jump right into this. So give me 2 seconds here. When you're ready, 60 seconds, let's hear it. Go.
So Jeffrey, I think the rant for today is about what we were just talking about. Founders sometimes get totally distracted by capital and funding as a proxy for them having a real business. And, you know, we were just talking about, I want people who are obsessive about the customer and the problem and that they're trying to solve it. And sometimes raising capital, they confuse for, hey, I've got a real opportunity here. I'm going to win. And capital is just giving you the lifeline to potentially go win and get the other people around you to go do that. And sometimes they think the money itself is the validation. And I think that's where I get really frustrated at times, and that they want me to get excited for them because they raised capital. And I say, great, now you have an opportunity, but use that as the fuel to go build the great business that you have in front of you. This is not validation on its own.
I love it. And I think from that perspective of the fact that we use validation by how much money I've garnered, there is a lot of founders that are really fantastic at raising funds and forget to build a business.
That's right.
But then there's the reverse, where you've got a lot of founders that are creating big, great businesses, but they aren't looking for capital. They're not understanding how the venture capital side works or the point of venture capital. So is there a happy medium inside of this? Is venture capital creating the problem by funding these FTXs and the WeWorks or the Wees and all these other companies where they're dumping tons of money in and they haven't actually looked at, is this a real business model? And they're following the FOMO at the same time.
Yes, absolutely. Both groups are complicit in my mind. You have founders that are good at playing the game and selling a vision for a platform that can consume a whole bunch of venture capital. And you have venture capitalists that have a need to deploy, in some cases, large chunks of capital. And we've seen a number of funds get increasingly larger. And that means they need to be able to deploy large amounts of capital when you have a big fund. And so both sides, I would say, have been complicit in taking their eyes at times off of the business fundamentals of what does it take to fund and build a great business. And where I tend to think about it is in the early stages of a business, why you typically need venture capital is because you have super high uncertainty and you need capital to help you learn and get to a more certain future. And because you have such high uncertainty, your best available capital source is a high risk, high reward capital source, otherwise known as venture capital. A bank is probably not going to give you capital in a high uncertainty environment. As that company becomes more clear and more certain how to invest capital into it, there often are better sources of capital than venture capital to fund it because you have much more input output certainty. And I think that's where at times founders or business operators aren't necessarily considering other alternatives that may be ultimately much lower cost options for them.
I love that high uncertainty. I've never had someone phrase it that way. And I think that's brilliant because it's exactly what it is. It's that there's these super high unknowns, and I believe I've got something here. I want to win, and I'm going to get all of these people to kind of circle around me, and we're going to all attack this uncertainty. And the risk level is that we can lose this all, or we're going to find our lane, and we're going to take that lane. Versus we have a great business, great lane, and people are just dumping in that money because you have a potential in 3 years to exit to the public markets. You've already found your lane. You're already moving forward. And now that's just less risk, way less risk. And it's more of just, can you keep and operate your business without the outside problems coming in and crushing you from governments to distribution of products, operations, whatever it might be. So there's a whole different side to that. And I don't think people look at venture as being this uncertain side. And I love the way that you phrased that. I think that makes a huge difference.
Thank you.
We're going to jump into our business rapid fire questions. Pick one or the other. Ready to roll?
Yes.
All right. Founder or co-founder?
Co-founder.
Unicorn or a four-year 10x exit?
Four-year 10x exit.
Love it. Tech or CPG?
Tech.
NFT or Web 3.0?
Good question. Probably Web 3.
AI or blockchain?
AI.
First-time founder or a second, third-time founder?
Probably second, third-time founder.
First money in or Series A?
I'm a first money in personality. I have sort of both these days, but yeah, I'd prefer it first.
Okay. Angel or VC?
Angel.
Board seat or observer?
Board seat.
Safe or convertible note?
Safe.
Lead or follow?
Lead.
Favorite part of investing?
Suspending disbelief and envisioning what this could look like if it really succeeded.
I like that. Number of companies invested per year?
I'm about 10 to 12 right now.
Huge. Love it. Verticals of focus?
Obviously, a lot in fintech and banking tech these days. Vertical market software, particularly as it increasingly is more and more intelligent and other tech-enabled services.
Two qualities a startup needs in order to stand out to you.
Founders who, as I mentioned earlier, have that just clear why that they have to go do this, and insights on why this is the right time to go change this industry.
Okay. What is the piece of advice you give founders 9 out of 10 times?
I think there are probably two. One is focus more on the customer and the problems of the customers, and deeply understanding, is this a problem we're solving that they are motivated and care about changing, and focus less on your product. And the second is understand, if you really are going to raise capital, is there a fair opportunity for the investor involved to make money? Have you thought about the math? And because far too often they haven't even thought through what that could look like for their business partners, the investors, to come alongside with them.
Do you have a philosophy or a rules that you stand behind?
I have a lot of them, as you probably heard throughout this. So I don't know that I will recite any more of them, but yes, many.
What tech will define the world in the next 5 years?
It's. I already feel a little bit, annoying with myself to say it, but I do think AI is having its moment. People are paying attention to it and how it will be used to augment humanity, make our lives much more creative and flexible. I'm pretty excited about.
Agreed. Who is your hero, mentor, and why?
My hero, I think, is my father. He's just been such a open and honest supporter, encourager, and frankly, enabler of me to say, you don't have to come back here and be a part of this family business. I want to see you go be the best version of yourself in the world. And I think just that gift, I'm so grateful for.
Brilliant. Toughest lesson you've learned as an investor?
People can disappoint you. And, even when you think they're who you think they are, they still, humans can let us down. And I think that's probably the toughest lesson to learn is, even when you feel like you're on the same page and you've got the same view of where things need to go, sometimes for any number of reasons, they can deviate and let you down. And that's just part of life.
True. What is the most important technology that you feel has been built today or will be built in the future?
I'll focus on the future because I don't know that it's been built yet. And I think it's in process, is helping us as humans understand what's inside of us at a much deeper level, at the biological level, at the psychological level. We are these incredibly complex machines. And I'm fascinated at times how little we actually know about them. And so I think, anything that's increasingly helping us understand what's happening inside, because we're in many cases becoming less and less connected to each other from a human standpoint and a more technological standpoint. And I'm not sure we even fully understand what that's doing to us. And so, that deeper understanding of the unique individual inside of each of us and the biology, chemistry, et cetera, of all that, I'm fascinated to see, what new technologies will emerge to assist that.
Likewise, we call it the human condition. There's so many things we don't know.
That's right.
What is your favorite investment that you've made?
My favorite investment? That is a good question. It probably right now is a company that I helped co-found last year called Bonus, and we are helping homeowners build a future wealth from their home. And it's something that has never been thought about, to help people build more wealth through home ownership. It's typically been something others have sort of preyed on and built businesses around as an industry, and homeowners have sort of benefited at times, but often not from owning homes. It's been much more utilitarian for a lot of people, even though it's, for a lot of folks in the US, their greatest asset. And so I think conceiving the concept of how we could change that, and it's, you know, because I got to be both the co-founder and first investor in it, I have high interest ownership and sort of that founder value in it. That's what probably makes it my current favorite.
Love it. What is one thing you would change about venture that doesn't flow or work for you today?
I struggle in the venture world. I understand it. I struggle with the spreadsheet-driven investing approach, in that in many cases they will pass on a deal because they can't get the ownership percentage, or they can't get the capital that their spreadsheet is telling them they need to put into a company. And I think this is such a creative and human business that those are the moments where I'm frustrated and say, this isn't the right way to do it. I think it's about helping people de-risk and build great businesses, and doing it with some guidelines and boundaries, but these really structured approaches to it that, you know, is more of a later, higher certainty, private equity driven approach, I think is in those early stages is just really frustrating. And I would say, you know, delusional, frankly.
Well said. All right, we're almost there. Personal questions. Most famous person that pops in your mind?
Abraham Lincoln.
Nice. First brand that pops in your mind?
Nike.
Book or movie?
Movie.
Superman or Batman?
Superman.
Fortune cookie or birthday cake?
Fortune cookie.
5 minutes with Bezos or Oprah?
Oprah.
Mountain or beach?
Beach.
Bike or run?
Run.
Big Mac or Chicken McNuggets?
Chicken McNuggets.
Trophy or money?
Trophy or money? Trophy.
Beer or wine?
Wine.
TED Talk or book reading?
TED Talk.
TikTok or Instagram?
Instagram.
Facebook or LinkedIn?
LinkedIn.
Favorite movie and what character would you play?
My favorite movie is probably Hoosiers, because it is a great story movie, and also it always reminds me where I came from. And, you know, I probably would play Gene Hackman, who's the coach.
That's a great movie, and I haven't probably seen it in 20 years, so I'm going to have to go check that one out. Very cool. Favorite book?
Probably the Bible.
Like it? Favorite sports team?
Go back to it all the time. Favorite sports team is my alma mater, Indiana University basketball team.
I like it. All right, cool. What is the meaning of success to you?
Success to me is, I think, two parts. One is becoming the best version of myself and challenging and growing into the person that I can be, that you can have then the biggest impact on the world. And that is, you know, how many people can I positively impact in the various ways that I can, through the skills that I've developed, through the groups that I've been a part of, and whether it's a lot or a little impact that I can have. So to me, that's success.
I love it. And what is your superpower?
I think probably what we talked about earlier, which is my ability to relate and have at least an initial meaningful conversation with almost anyone. And that curiosity that drives me to engage with them around that.
I 100% agree with that. I think it's a fantastic skill set. So great superpower. Well, I'm going to say, Kerry, it's been a pleasure getting the opportunity to learn more about yourself and to dive into your background and to the future. And you're a rock star. It was phenomenal. Lots, so much learning. I've got millions of pages of notes. And I just wanted to say thank you very much for all of your time. And the way we want to and we like to end our show is we like to give you the last word. So anything you want to share to founders or investors, I turn it over to you. And please also share how people can get in touch with you as well.
Well, Jeffrey, it's been a pleasure. I don't get a chance to answer these kinds of questions very often. And it was enjoyable. I really appreciate it. So thank you for putting me on the spot and giving me the opportunity. Final thought, I have such a huge heart for entrepreneurs. I love people who want to go out and dent the universe and make something better for the world. And it's just such an inspiring thing. And it's so hard. And it's hard to say no. It's hard to say no to them. It's hard to not want to support them all. And, you know, I just encourage all of them to keep going, and they'll find their way, whatever that way is supposed to be, even if we can't be a part of it. The easiest way to find me these days is probably on LinkedIn. I'm pretty active on there. I try to be as responsive as I can be. You know, we have websites both for Operate at operatestudio.com. You can contact us there, and Bank Tech Ventures at banktechventures.com as well. And I just, as I said, love seeing the entrepreneurial energy that continues to exist. And in fact, I think is even growing in our world. And I'm privileged to be a small part of it.
I love it, Kerry. You got a fantastic podcast. You've done amazing startups and a great venture studio. So thank you for all your time. Keep up the amazing works. It's brilliant. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, it's a great conversation with Kerry. So many great points that he brought up there. And I think I'll just touch on a few of them, which is obviously trying and working to find your tribe. And that goes for building your company. When you start all the way through your journey, you're always going to be tying in people into this journey. So find that tribe and be curious. Stay curious. Curiosity is what creates such an exciting, awesome world, is that the people that have the ability to have this curiosity are the ones that can help drive and make the change. Challenge yourself. Everything you do, keep challenging yourself to learn more, be better every day. And I guess the other things that it would really tie into that is when you are looking for an accelerator incubator where you're working your way into these new startup phase, figure out what your real problem is. Figure out what things you're not able to attack, build, or grow from. And once you figure those out, that will kind of lead you into, if it's an accelerator, incubator, or venture studio, but really start to hone in on what that problem is and how you can propel yourself forward. Dent the universe. I love that saying. He just said that at the end. Make a dent. Figure out how you can make a change and do something that people will appreciate in the future. You know, be strong. And have a strong, strong why on what you're doing. I think that will really help carry you forward and figure out what your unfair advantage is. What are things that are going to make you better than everybody else? And then just be the best at it. That's really the key to entrepreneurship. Be the best. Thank you for joining us today. If you've enjoyed this conversation, please feel free to share with your friends, subscribe to our YouTube channel, and or please follow us on Spotify, Apple, or Stitcher platforms. Feel free to share an audio video clip around the show, and we may include it in one of our future podcasts. You can find us or follow us at marketing@oppeoplenetwork.com or on LinkedIn at Supporters Fund. Your support and comments are truly appreciated. Please visit us at supportersfund.com or startup events at openpeoplenetwork.com. Thank you and have a fantastic day.